patiently, not judging, clearly having gone through this before. Eventually, someone volunteered, and then another. Our speaking assignment was something simple. I think we simply had to say something about ourselves. For most people, including me, this was a relatively easy task. But for many in the class, it was nearly impossible. One young lady who had been forced by her employer to take the class was so frightened that she literally couldn't form words. In the cool, air-conditioned room, beads of sweat ran from her forehead down to her chin and dropped onto the carpet. The audience watched in shared pain as she battled her own demons and tried to form words. A few words came out, just barely, and she returned to her seat, defeated, humiliated, broken. Then an interesting thing happened. I rank it as one of the most fascinating things I have ever witnessed. The instructor went to the front and looked at the broken student. The room was dead silent. I'll always remember his words. He said, "Wow, that was brave." My brain spun in my head. 20-some students had been thinking this woman had just crashed and burned in the most dramatically humiliating way. She had clearly thought the same thing. In 4 words, the instructor had completely reinterpreted the situation. Every one of us knew the instructor was right. We had just witnessed an extraordinary act of personal bravery, the likes of which one rarely sees. That was the takeaway. Period. I looked at the student's face as she reacted to the instructor's comment. She had been alone in her misery, fighting a losing fight. But somehow the instructor understood what was happening inside her, and he respected it. I swear I saw a light come on in her eyes. She looked up from the floor. She had a reprieve. She was still in the fight. The next week she volunteered to speak again. See how powerful this volunteering thing is? She owned the choice. She didn't do well, but she got through it without perspiring or locking up, and the instructor praised her for her progress. By the end of the course, some weeks later, every member of the class could have sold Tony Snow's product. Every time we spoke, we got compliments from the instructor and sometimes other students. We got applause. It felt great. Today, when I see a stage and 1,000 people waiting to hear me speak, a little recording goes off in my head that says, "Today is a good day." I'm the happiest person in the room. The audience only gets to listen, but I get to speak, to feel, to be fully alive. I will absorb their energy and turn it into something good. And when I'm done, there's a 100% chance that people will say good things about me. There are several things to learn from that story. The most important is the transformative power of praise versus the corrosive impact of criticism. I've had a number of occasions since then to test the powers of praise, and I find it an amazing force, especially for adults. Children are accustomed to a continual stream of criticisms and praise, but adults can go weeks without a compliment while enduring criticism both at work and at home. Adults are starved for a kind word. When you understand the power of honest praise, as opposed to bullshitting, flattery, and sucking up, you realize that withholding it borders on immoral. If you see something that impresses you, a decent respect to humanity insists you voice your praise. "Wow, that was brave," is the best and cleanest example I've seen in which looking at something in a different way changes everything. When the instructor switched our focus from the student's poor speaking performance to her bravery, everything changed. Positivity is far more than a mental preference. It changes your brain, literally, and it changes the people around you. It's the nearest thing we have to magic. Another thing I learned from my Dale Carnegie experience is that we don't always have an accurate view of our own potential. I think most people who are frightened of public speaking can't imagine they might feel different as a result of training. Don't assume you know how much potential you have. Sometimes the only way to know what you can do is to test yourself. psychology. It's hard to imagine any business or social activity that doesn't require a basic understanding of how the human brain perceives the world. Almost any decision you make is in the context of managing what other people will think of you. We are all in the business of selling some version of ourselves. Psychology is embedded in everything we do. For example, a real estate salesperson might show you the worst house first, knowing it will make you appreciate the better home you see later, and it might make you reach deeper in your pockets. A car salesman knows that a high sticker price will make the eventual negotiated price look better than it would have otherwise. Salespeople know they can manipulate buyers by controlling what they compare. A building contractor knows that when customers see the house during the framing phase, the rooms will look too small. Later, when the rooms are finished and furnished, they look larger. A smart builder warns the customers in advance that everything will look smaller in the framing phase. That way, the customer doesn't flip out. That's psychology. Even an engineer who deals mostly with the material world needs to understand how his boss feels, how customers feel, and how users will perceive the product. You can't get away from the need to make decisions based on psychology. The examples I gave are the common ones that most people figure out on their own. But given that the field of psychology is miles deep, most people know only the stuff that qualifies as common knowledge. How much more effective would you be if you had a greater understanding of psychology? Answer: a lot. Psychology was a huge factor in my eventual success with Dilbert. By the time United Media offered me a syndication contract for Dilbert, my confidence had taken some direct hits. The other syndication companies had turned me down flat. One editor had suggested that perhaps I could find an actual artist to do the drawing for me. Ouch! So when Sarah Gillespie, editor at United Media, called and offered a contract, I apologized for my poor drawing skills and suggested that perhaps she could pair me with someone who could do the artwork. Sarah, who evidently understood a lot about psychology, told me my drawing skill was fine, no improvement necessary. That triggered a highly unexpected change in my actual level of talent. It went up. Overnight, my drawing skill went from about a 3 on a scale of 1 to 10 to about a 6. That's still not good, but apparently it was good enough. The sudden improvement was entirely due to Sarah's compliment of my artistic ability. I became a more confident artist, and a better one, because she changed what I thought of my own talent. It was a Wizard of Oz moment. When I look at the list of my personal failures and successes, one of the things that stand out is psychology. When I got the psychology right, either by accident or by cleverness, things worked out better. When I was blind to the psychology, things went badly. For example, after Dilbert became a hit, I briefly considered launching a second comic. I posted on Dilbert.com some early samples of what I hoped would be a comic about a young Elbonian boy who didn't fit in. His name was Plop, and he was the only unbearded Elbonian in the world, and that included the women and babies. On day one, the Plop comic was a lot better than the first Dilbert comics, but not nearly as good as Dilbert had become by that time. What I didn't count on, my blind spot, was that my new comic would be compared with Dilbert, not with other new comics. Compared with Dilbert, it was flat and lacked an edge. Compared with all of the new comics that launched that same year from unknown cartoonists, it was fairly competitive. Most of my feedback by email was of the keep your day job variety, along with, it's no Dilbert. I wouldn't have guessed that being a successful cartoonist would be a barrier to launching a new comic, but in my case, it was. I could have saved a lot of time if I'd understood that in advance. Dilbert was the first syndicated comic that focused primarily on the workplace. At the time, there was nothing to compare it with. That allowed me to get away with bad artwork and immature writing until I could improve my skills to the not-so-embarrassing level. Since the launch of Dilbert in 1989, dozens of cartoonists have tried to enter the workplace comic space and gotten clobbered by unfavorable comparisons to a mature Dilbert. If I were to disguise my identity and launch a new workplace comic tomorrow with all new characters, readers would compare it with Dilbert and it wouldn't stand a chance. Over the past 10 years or so, I have been in a few dozen meetings on the topic of turning Dilbert into a feature film. I always get the question of how we could make a Dilbert movie different enough from the TV show The Office or the cult movie Office Space. The implication is that the quality of a Dilbert movie might be less important to its success than whatever the public reflexively compares it with. Quality is not an independent force in the universe. It depends on what you choose as your frame of reference. When my restaurant partner and I built our second restaurant, we decided to make it more upscale than the first so it wouldn't cannibalize business, given that the two restaurants were only 5 miles apart. The upscale decor strategy seemed like a perfectly good idea until I observed women walk in for lunch, look at the upscale decor, look at their own casual clothes, and proclaim to the hostess that they were underdressed. The self-assessed underdressed customer would turn and leave. I saw that scenario repeat itself over and over. None of the women who rejected themselves from the restaurant looked underdressed to me. The restaurant wasn't that upscale. It was still a neighborhood restaurant in a suburban strip mall, but compared with other restaurants in the area, it was a step up in design. It made people feel uncomfortable. To make matters worse, our food quality wasn't up to the level people expected for a place with that type of decor. The restaurant's appearance caused us to be compared with the very best of fine dining restaurants. Our business model assumed people would prefer eating upscale comfort food in an unusually attractive setting. It was a bad idea. Customers were confused. Was the restaurant supposed to be casual or upscale? People compared our decor with casual restaurants and decided it was too fancy to be a casual eating experience. They compared our food with the top restaurants in San Francisco and decided it wasn't sufficiently special. We failed to predict how customers would compare us. This book itself presents an especially challenging comparison problem. If I add too much humor to this book, reviewers and readers will compare it with other humor books, and it will come up short because many of the chapters don't lend themselves to jokes. If I leave out all humor, the book will be compared with self-help books, which would be misleading in its own way, but I'd probably come out better in that sort of comparison. In other words, to increase your perceived enjoyment of the book, I might leave out some humor that you would otherwise enjoy. When I talk of the comparison problem, I don't mean a simple comparison of one thing with its competition. If the competition is simply better than you, your problem is more than customer perceptions. I'm talking about comparisons that common sense tells you should be irrelevant, such as comparing Dilbert the TV show to The Simpsons. They weren't competitors in any real way. They didn't run during the same time or exhaust the limited supply of the public's discretionary time in any meaningful way. And yet the comparison to The Simpsons was a big obstacle to the show's success because it contrasted a seasoned, big-budget show against a poorly funded upstart that was still trying to find its rhythm. Animated shows take longer to tune than live action, because the writers for animation can't know what worked in a particular show until it is fully animated and too late to change. Success in anything usually means doing more of what works and less of what doesn't, and for animated TV shows, that means you don't hit your pace until about the third season. We got canceled after the second half season. I believe that if The Simpsons had never existed as the gold standard of animated primetime TV shows, The Dilbert Show would have had time to reach the next level. I've spent a lot of time describing just one psychological phenomenon, the tendency to make irrational comparisons. But how many psychological tips and tricks does a person really need to understand in order to be successful in life? My best guess is that there are a few hundred rules in psychology that you should have a passing familiarity with. I've been absorbing information in this field for decades, and I don't feel that I am getting anywhere near the end of it. And just about everything I learn about human psychology ends up being helpful. I went to Wikipedia to get a quick list of the psychological and cognitive traps that humans often fall into. Psychology is an immense field and well beyond the scope of this book. My point is to impress upon you how many useful nuggets of information are at your disposal, and most of them are free. Every psychological trap on this list can be used to manipulate you. If there's something on this list that you're not familiar with, you're vulnerable to deception. In some cases, you're missing opportunities to make your product and yourself more attractive to others. It's a good idea to make psychology your lifelong study. Most of what you need to know as a regular citizen can be gleaned from the Internet. A partial list of cognitive biases listed on Wikipedia are belief bias, empathy gap, exaggerated expectation, hindsight bias, illusion of control, irrational escalation, misattribution, misinformation effect, observer expectancy effect, omission bias, outcome bias, ostrich effect, and self-serving bias, to name but a few. The entire list documents over 150 cognitive biases. It looks like a lot to know, but you have your entire life to acquire the knowledge. Think of it as a system in which you learn a bit every year. That will be easier if you understand how important psychology is to everything you want to accomplish in life. On a scale of 1 to 10, the importance of understanding psychology is a solid 10. Some of the things on the list are common sense, and you might know them by other names. And I would go so far as to say that anything on the list that you don't understand might cost you money in the future. You've heard the old saying that knowledge is power, but knowledge of psychology is the purest form of that power. No matter what you're doing or how well you're doing it, you can benefit from a deeper understanding of how the mind interprets its world using only the clues that somehow find a way into your brain through the holes in your skull. When I was in my 20s, I took a certification course in hypnosis. I thought it would be fascinating and maybe useful. I even considered making some money on the side as a hypnotist. I decided against it because I didn't want to be in the business of selling my time. But the skills and insights I gleaned from studying hypnosis have improved my performance in just about everything I've done since then, from business to my personal life. It was time well spent. In hypnosis, you don't spend a lot of time asking why one technique works and why another does not. Hypnosis is largely a trial and error process that uses your own experience plus that of hypnotists who have gone before to reduce the number of wrong moves. In that sense, hypnosis treats people as if they were machines that can be programmed. If you provide the right inputs, you get the outputs you want. Hypnosis is an inexact process because every brain has a different mix of chemistry. For example, if I ask you to relax and imagine a forest in the summer, most of you would find that a pleasing image. But people who are afraid of bears or afraid of getting lost might get agitated by the thought of a forest. A hypnotist learns to detect slight changes in breathing, posture, movement, and skin tone to know if the images presented are working as planned. Adjustments are made accordingly. In the simplest terms, a hypnotist tries to do more of whatever works and less of what doesn't. My experience with hypnosis completely changed the way I view people and how I interpret the choices they make. I no longer see reason as the driver of behavior. I see simple cause and effect, similar to the way machines operate. If you believe people use reason for the important decisions in life, you will go through life feeling confused and frustrated that others seem to have bad reasoning skills. The reality is that reason is just one of the drivers of our decisions, and often the smallest one. Recently, my wife and I went shopping for a new vehicle. We looked at a lot of models online and in person, and none were irresistible. Then we came upon a vehicle that was so us that I laughed when I saw it. I could almost feel my brain make up its mind before we had done one iota of reasoning, data gathering, or negotiating. I could tell that my wife had the same experience. This car was so obviously going to belong to us that seeing it was like peering into the future. Predictably, everything we learned about the car after that point seemed either good or good enough. We convinced ourselves that the price was reasonable. We convinced ourselves that the features were just what we wanted. And eventually, we convinced ourselves that we had negotiated a good deal. The normal way people would look at our car buying experience is that we saw a model that looked good enough to interest us, then we did research and applied our reason and came to a rational decision. The reality is quite different. The amateur hypnotist in me knows that our visceral reaction to the car was the beginning and end of the thinking that went into the purchase. Our powers of reason did some due diligence to make sure it met our basic requirements, but we already knew it would. The purchase was an irrational decision that tried and failed to sell itself to me as the product of reason. It is tremendously useful to know when people are using reason and when they are rationalizing the irrational. You're wasting your time if you try to make someone see reason when reason is not influencing the decision. If you've ever had a frustrating political debate with your friend who refuses to see the logic in your argument, you know what I mean. But keep in mind that the friend sees you exactly the same way. When politicians tell lies, they know the press will call them out. They also know it doesn't matter. Politicians understand that reason will never have much of a role in voting decisions. A lie that makes a voter feel good is more effective than 100 rational arguments. That's even true when the voter knows the lie is a lie. If you're perplexed at how society can tolerate politicians who lie so blatantly, you're thinking of people as rational beings. That worldview is frustrating and limiting. People who study hypnosis start to view humans as moist machines that are simply responding to inputs with programmed outputs. No reasoning is involved beyond eliminating the most absurd options. Your reasoning can prevent you from voting for a total imbecile, but it won't stop you from supporting a halfwit with a great haircut. If your view of the world is that people use reason for their important decisions, you are setting yourself up for a life of frustration and confusion. You'll find yourself continually debating people and never winning except in your own mind. Few things are as destructive and limiting as a worldview that assumes people are mostly rational. On an episode of The Bachelorette, a show on ABC, one of the contending single men played a practical joke on the young woman he hoped to marry. The joke involved taking her to his parents' home and convincing her that he still lived there, which he didn't. The joke was well executed, complete with a fake bedroom that was a disgusting mess. What the suitor failed to understand is that the bachelorette would still feel the scenario in the joke long after the truth was revealed. In the bachelorette's mind, the irrational part that we all have, the memory of this fellow being a live-at-home loser was like a stain that couldn't be removed. I think the bachelorette genuinely appreciated the joke and had a good laugh, but my wife and I turned to each other and said, "He's toast." He was eliminated soon after. We can't know how much impact the joke had on the bachelorette's decision, but my training with hypnosis tells me it was probably huge. Apple owes much of its success to Steve Jobs' understanding that the way a product makes users feel trumps most other considerations, including price. If Steve Jobs had seen people as rational beings, he might have followed a path similar to Dell, selling highly capable machines at the lowest possible price. Dell succeeded too, of course, but if buyers were rational, there would have been only one computer manufacturer left after about a year. Consumers would always buy the best computer for the money and drive out the bad players overnight. Luckily for Dell and several other Windows computer manufacturers, There are enough irrational people with poor information to keep several companies afloat so long as their products are confusingly similar. Jobs' worldview led him to a business model with high margins, whereas Windows computers have become commodities. If you feel I'm overstating the case that people are irrational, allow me to put some boundaries on that idea. People certainly make the small decisions based on rational considerations. You probably invest your money in ways that are prudent, or so you think. But keep in mind that the financial meltdown of 2009 happened because even the best minds in finance were irrationally optimistic about financial instruments they couldn't hope to understand. Rational behavior is especially useless in any situation that is too complex for a human to grasp. Cell phone companies exploit that fact by offering pricing plans that are too complicated to compare with the competition. I coined the word confusopoly to describe that strategy. The intent is to prevent consumers from using whatever small reasoning power they possess to compare prices and features. Instead, consumers make largely uninformed decisions and convince themselves they did well. I speak from experience, having moved from one cell phone carrier to another recently, while planning a third move soon. I tell myself that each of the moves was based on price, coverage, and features. But reason didn't help me the first two times I chose a cell phone carrier, and it probably won't help the next time because the pricing plans are intentionally hard to compare. I don't think you need to become a hypnotist to understand human psychology, although it helps. But I do think a working knowledge of psychology is essential to your success, both personally and professionally. Consider it a lifelong learning process. You'll be glad you did. Over time, it starts to feel like a superpower that allows you to understand things that confuse and confound those around you. Business writing. I never took a writing class in high school or in college. I learned the basics in English classes, and that seemed good enough. I could write sentences that people understood. What else did I need? I did notice that some people in the business world wrote with an impressive level of clarity and persuasiveness, but I figured that was just because those people were extra smart. It never occurred to me that there was some technique involved and that we unwashed citizens could easily learn it. One day during my corporate career, I signed up for a company-sponsored class in business writing. This was part of my larger strategy of learning as much as I could about whatever might someday be useful while my employer was willing to foot the bill. I didn't have high hopes that the class would change my life. I was just looking for some tips and tricks for better writing. I was very wrong about how useful the class would be. If I recall, the class was only 2 afternoons long, and it was life-altering. As it turns out, business writing is all about getting to the point and leaving out all of the noise. You think you already do that in your writing, but you probably don't. Consider the previous sentence. I intentionally embedded some noise. Did you catch it? The sentence that starts with, "You think you already do that," includes the unnecessary word, "already." Remove it and you get exactly the same meaning. You think you do that. The already part is assumed and unnecessary. That sort of realization is the foundation of business writing. Business writing also teaches that brains are wired to better understand concepts that are presented in a certain order. For example, your brain processes "the boy hit the ball" more easily than "the ball was hit by the boy." In editor's jargon, the first sentence is direct writing and the second is passive. It's a tiny difference, but over the course of an entire document, passive writing adds up and causes reader fatigue. Eventually, I learned that the so-called persuasive writers were doing little more than using ordinary business writing methods. Clean writing makes a writer seem smarter, and it makes the writer's arguments more persuasive. Business writing is also the foundation for humor writing. Unnecessary words and passive writing kill the timing of humor the same way they kill the persuasiveness of your point. If you want people to see you as smart, persuasive, and funny, consider taking a 2-day class in business writing. There aren't many skills you can learn in 2 days that will serve you this well. Accounting. I found accounting nearly impossible to learn because of the bubbling moat of boredom that surrounds the entire field. But a basic understanding of accounting is necessary to be a fully effective adult in a modern society, even if you never do any actual accounting on your own. Accounting is part of the vocabulary of business, and if you don't understand it on a concept level, the world will be a confusing place. In particular, it's helpful to be able to create your own cash flow projection on a spreadsheet and feel some confidence that you understand the tax impacts and the so-called time value of money. Accounting overlaps with the fields of economics and business, and in each of those fields, you need an understanding of accounting practices. In my town, there's a tiny restaurant that has changed hands several times, always with a new concept and menu. The one thing that all of the concepts have in common is that they can't work because there aren't enough tables in the place to cover their expenses. I have a good idea what their expenses are because I once owned 2 restaurants in the area. My guess is that each new operator has plenty of culinary skill and no accounting skill. No one with accounting skill would get involved with a business model that can't work on paper. You can pay others to do your accounting and cash flow projections, but that only works if you can check their work in a meaningful way. The smarter play is to learn enough about accounting and spreadsheets that you understand the basics. Design. In today's world, we're all designers, whether we like it or not. You might be designing PowerPoint presentations or a website for your startup or flyers for your kids' school event. You're also furnishing your home, buying clothes you hope look nice to others, and so on. Design used to be the exclusive domain of artists and other experts. Now we're all expected to have a working understanding of design. If you're like me, you were born with no design skills whatsoever. I was amazed to learn well into my adult years that design is actually rules-based. One need not have an eye for design. Knowing the rules is good enough for civilians. For example, landscape designers will tell you that it's better to put 3 of the same kind of bush in your yard, not 2 and not 4. Odd numbers just look better in that context. You don't need an eye for design to count to 3. And you get the same result as the expert, at least in that limited example. I also learned that art composition for anything from a magazine cover to an oil painting to a PowerPoint slide should conform to a few basic templates. The most common is the L-shaped layout. You imagine a giant letter L on the page and fill in the dense stuff along its shape, leaving less clutter in one of the 4 open quadrants. Artists call the uncluttered part negative space. In the case of an oil painting, you might have a tree going up one side, some landscape on the bottom, and the open sky in the top left. You can change it up by rotating the L and leaving a different quadrant less busy than the rest, but it's still the L concept. When you take a photograph, you can use the same concept. Instead of centering the person in the pictures, adjust your field until the person is one side of the L and the ground is the bottom. The less busy quadrant might be some landscape or the sunset. When you design a PowerPoint slide or a web page, it's the same idea. You leave one quadrant less busy than the rest. Skim through any well-designed magazine and you'll see the L design in 80% of the art and photography. The other 20% will be some special cases that I won't go into here. I'm only trying to convince you of the importance of design and the ease with which you can pick up the main idea. Learn just a few design tricks and people will think you're smarter without knowing exactly why. Conversation. Few people are skilled conversationalists. Most people are just talking, which is not the same thing. The difference is that skilled conversationalists have learned techniques that are surprisingly non-obvious to a lot of people. I was among the clueless about conversation skills for the first half of my life. When I was a teen, I thought conversation was a complete waste of time and something to be avoided. I was aware that there were several alleged reasons for conversation, but I didn't see much value in them. I was a bore. There are probably a dozen or more reasons to have a conversation, depending on how you slice it. You might start a conversation to exchange information, plan, complain, entertain, feel connected, befriend, seduce, persuade, be polite, avoid awkward silence, brag. A bad conversationalist will focus on the impoverished part of the list, doing a lot of bragging, complaining, and exchanging of information. It's fair to say that such a person doesn't understand what conversation is or how to do it. I fell into that category for the first few decades of my life. My first inkling that conversation was a learnable skill and that the benefits of conversation were larger than I imagined happened while I was taking the Dale Carnegie course I mentioned earlier. The focus of the class was on public speaking, but we also learned techniques for making conversation with strangers, such as one might in a party or business situation. The technique is laughably simple and 100% effective. All you do is introduce yourself and ask questions until you find a point of mutual interest. I'll paraphrase the Dale Carnegie question stack as best I remember it. It goes something like this. 1. What's your name? 2. Where do you live? 3. Do you have a family? 4. What do you do for a living? 5. Do you have any hobbies, sports? 6. Do you have any travel plans? If you're like me, the questions seem a bit too awkward and personal for someone you just met. Prior to experiencing the Dale Carnegie course, I would meet someone new and immediately go into joking mode because I didn't know what else to talk about. I discovered that perhaps only 5% of the general population wants to get into joking mode with a stranger. And of that 5%, maybe only half of them will appreciate whatever you think is funny. Everyone else will want you to go away. While most people enjoy humor, the typical person doesn't go directly there before getting to know someone. The secret to making the list of 6 questions work without seeming awkward is in understanding that the person you meet will feel every bit as awkward as you. That person wants to talk about something interesting and to sound knowledgeable. Your job is to make that easy. Nothing is easier than talking about oneself. I would go so far as to say that 99% of the general public love talking about themselves. When you ask a stranger a personal question, you make that person happy. Your question relieves the stress of awkward silence and gets the conversation moving. Best of all, it signals that you have interest in the stranger, which most people interpret as friendliness and social confidence, even if you're faking it. And faking social confidence leads to the real thing over time. Your job as a conversationalist is to keep asking questions and keep looking for something you have in common with the stranger, or something that interests you enough to wade into the topic. In my entire life, I have never met a stranger who didn't have some fascinating life experiences that spilled out if I asked the right questions. Everyone is interesting if you make the situation feel safe. Here's a summary of good conversation technique. 1. Ask questions. 2. Don't complain much. 3. Don't talk about boring experiences, TV show, meal, dream, etc. 4. Don't dominate the conversation. Let others talk. 5. Don't get stuck on a topic. Keep moving. 6. Planning is useful, but it isn't conversation. 7. Keep the sad stories short, especially medical stories. The point of conversation is to make the other person feel good. If you do that one simple thing correctly, the other benefits come along with the deal. For example, a person who likes you is more likely to be persuaded, to recommend you for good opportunities, to share information, and to want a relationship with you. And if you must complain because it's just too hard to keep it in, you're better off complaining to someone who already likes you. That way, you'll get the empathy you want. So how do you get a stranger to like you? It's simple, actually. It starts by smiling and keeping your body language open. After that, just ask questions and listen as if you cared, all the while looking for common interests. Everyone likes to talk about his or her own life, and everyone appreciates a sympathetic listener. Eventually, if you discover some common interests, you'll feel a connection without any effort. If you're physically attractive, it probably isn't a good idea to talk too much. People are predisposed to liking attractive people. Talking can only make things worse. If you're attractive, be sure you've created a solid connection before discussing your hobby of collecting baby animal skulls or whatever the hell you're into. The less you say, the better, at least in the early stages of getting to know someone. If you're unattractive, and this is my area of expertise, your conversation skills will be especially important. It might be all you have to sell yourself, unless you're accomplished in some world-class way. You'll need to take your conversation skills up a notch, and that means becoming the master of short but interesting stories. As a writer, I reflexively translate whatever I observe into a story form with a setup, a twist if there is one, and some sort of punchline or thought that ties it in a bow. You can do the same thing. Try to get in the habit of asking yourself how you can turn your interesting experiences into story form. I find it helps to imagine telling the story to someone in particular, a spouse, friend, or relative. Try a few versions in your head, telling the story and feeling how it goes. Was it brief? Did you save the surprise for just the right moment? Did you have a way to end the story with a punchline or interesting observation? It's a good idea to always have a backlog of stories you can pull out at a moment's notice. And you'll want to continually update your internal story database with new material. For example, if I know I'll be seeing friends in a few days, I make a special note to myself to turn my recent experiences into story form, because I know I'll have a reason to bust one out. The most popular type of stories is funny stories. I think everyone should learn how to tell a funny story. I don't think people realize that storytelling is a learnable skill and not a genetic gift. Once you know the parts that compose any good story, you have all you need to sculpt your own out of your everyday experiences. The most important key to good storytelling is preparation. You don't want to figure out your story as you tell it. If something story-worthy happens to you, spend some time developing the story structure in your head, a structure I will explain in a minute, and practice telling the story in your head until you have it down. The basic parts of a good party story are setup. There's only one important rule for a story setup. Keep it brief. And I mean really brief, as in, so I took my car in for a brake job. That's it. Don't tell us the problem with the brakes. Don't tell us what made you think you had a brake problem, unless for some reason it is relevant. Try to keep your setup to one sentence, two at most. Pattern. Establish a pattern that your story will violate. For example, you could say, "Whenever I take my car for any kind of service, I'm always amazed how expensive it is." That establishes the pattern. Now we know that what follows will be a violation of the pattern, and we call that hint of things to come foreshadowing. Foreshadowing means you leave some clues about where the story is going. The foreshadowing can happen as early as the setup, as in, "My in-laws in Arkansas have something they call the Frady Hole that everyone climbs into in case of tornadoes. It's meant to hold no more than four people." That's the setup with the foreshadowing built in. The characters. Every story involves characters, and you might be one of them. For people who know all of your foibles, defects, and preferences, no elaboration is required. But if you are talking to strangers or talking about unfamiliar others, fill in the story with some character traits that will be relevant. For example, Our friend Bob has been borrowing our power tools for years because he's too cheap to buy his own. That sort of brief character profile is essential to any story that involves people. All good stories are about personalities. Relatability. There is one topic that people care more about than any other: themselves. Pick story topics that your listeners will relate to. If your story is about dealing with a stubborn bureaucrat, most adults can relate to it no matter the bureaucracy involved. But if your story is about the inner workings of competitive quilting, you'd better make it short and extra witty. People drift off when you stop talking about stuff that isn't, well, them. The twist. Your story isn't a story unless something unexpected or unusual happens. That's the plot twist. If you don't have a twist, it's not a story. It's just a regurgitation of your day. That's fine for catching up with a spouse, but it won't make you the life of the party. Topics to avoid. It's important to tell stories about interesting events. It's even more important to avoid telling stories about deadly boring or downer situations. Here are a few topics you should avoid. Food. People don't care how good your meal was unless they plan to eat at the same place soon. I will agree that some extreme foodies can actually get pleasure from hearing about food, but even in that case, you want to keep it short. Television show plots. Talking about TV shows that you and your conversation partner both enjoy can be fun and entertaining. But no one wants to hear the entire plot of a television show that you watched and they didn't. Dreams. No one cares about the details of your dream. If you must discuss your dreams, keep it to one sentence, as in, "I dreamed that a chipmunk with a face that looked like Winston Churchill was swimming in my cereal bowl." Medical stories. If you are normal or anywhere near it, you will talk too much about your health issues, no matter how persuasively I tell you that it's a bad idea. And people will ask about your health if they know there's something wrong with you. So you can't entirely avoid talking about your medical problems. Just keep your stories light, funny if possible, and short. Most important, recognize that it's your responsibility to change the subject as soon as you can. Other people will feel awkward changing the subject from your health problems because there's no way to do it gracefully. That's your job. And yes, I realize this book has a lot of health-related stories in it. But I'm a professional, and if I did my job right, you're curious how my voice problem turned out. Smile, ask questions, avoid complaining and sad topics, and have some entertaining stories ready to go. It's all you need to be in the top 10% of all conversationalists. Overcoming shyness. If you take a human from a remote tribe where no one has ever heard of a thing called swimming, and you throw him in the ocean, he'll probably panic and drown. Swimming isn't entirely natural to humans. We need to learn it. Luckily, we humans learn to swim fairly easily with a little practice. Shyness is analogous to swimming in the sense that we aren't born with the tools to overcome our own shyness, and some of us have more natural shyness than others. But as with swimming, we can learn to overcome shyness with a little practice. And it's worth the effort. Otherwise, you'll find yourself socially drowning at every gathering or public talk. I was so shy when I was in my 20s that I would drive to a party, park my car, break into a full sweat, then drive home without even saying hello. I credit one of my college friends with teaching me the secret of overcoming shyness by imagining you are acting instead of interacting. And by that, I mean literally acting. It turns out that a shy person can act like someone else far more easily than he can act like himself. That makes some sense because shyness is caused by an internal feeling that you are not worthy to be in the conversation. Acting like someone else gets you out of that way of thinking. When I fake my way past my natural shyness, I like to imagine a specific confident person I know well. I do my bad impression of that person, and it comes off much better than my default routine of breaking into a sweat, laughing too hard at my own jokes, and excusing myself to go sit in a corner and perspire. I also like to keep a few things in mind when I feel shyness coming on. First, I remember that most people feel awkward in social situations at least some of the time. Chances are that the person you are talking to is feeling just as shy. It helps me to know I'm probably on a level playing field. The other person is only pretending to be socially talented, just as I am. The single best tip for avoiding shyness involves harnessing the power of acting interested in other people. You don't want to cross into nosiness, but everyone appreciates it when you show interest. You should also try to figure out which people are thing people and which ones are people people. Thing people enjoy hearing about new technology and other clever tools and possessions. They also enjoy discussions of processes and systems, including politics. People people enjoy only conversations that involve humans doing interesting things. They get bored in a second when the conversation turns to things. Once you know whether you are dealing with a thing person or a people person, you can craft your conversation to his or her sweet spot. It makes a big difference in how people react to you, and that in turn will make you more confident and less shy. People who appear outgoing are usually employing a learned social skill that you think is somehow natural. It probably isn't, at least not entirely. Outgoing people usually come from families with at least one outgoing parent. They observe and imitate. Being outgoing is partly genetic, but you still need to know what to say when. That part is learned, and the good news is that you can learn it too. Observe outgoing people and steal their little tricks if you can. I've been doing that for years. It works great. I also find it helpful to remind myself that every human is a mess on the inside. It's easy to assume the good-looking and well-spoken person in front of you has it all together and is therefore your superior. The reality is that everyone is a basket case on the inside. Some people just hide it better. Find me a normal person, and I'll show you someone you don't know that well. It helps to remind yourself that your own flaws aren't that bad compared with everyone else's. I also recommend exercising your ego the way you'd exercise any other muscle. Try putting yourself in situations that will surely embarrass you if things go wrong, or maybe even if they don't. Like any other skill, suppressing shyness takes practice. The more you put yourself in potentially embarrassing situations, the easier they all become. In the interest of full disclosure, my own shyness dissipated when I realized I was semi-famous and I had an interesting profession. Success builds confidence, and confidence suppresses shyness. If you can't control your shyness directly through the tricks I outlined, wait until you're rich and famous. The shyness might leave on its own. Second language. I never learned a second language, despite years of trying. I can ace written tests in language classes, but when I hear another language spoken, it all sounds like a clothes dryer full of mumbling clowns. Apparently, my brain doesn't have the right wiring for learning additional languages. A second language can qualify you for a large range of jobs and opportunities compared with your monolingual peers. Where I live, in California, Spanish is the obvious choice for a second language. I've met quite a few small business people who use Spanish to manage their employees. And if you plan to get a job that involves working with the public, Spanish is essential, at least in California. Your situation will differ, but it always makes sense to know an extra language. It's a huge competitive advantage. If any of this chapter sounds painfully obvious, keep in mind that lots of different folks will listen to a book like this. And I remember my own galactic ignorance as a young man. It's surprising how uncommon common sense is. Also, keep in mind that California schools still teach French for some ridiculous reason. So clearly someone hasn't gotten the common sense memo. Golf. It's an old cliché that business gets done on the golf course. I'm new to the game, but as far as I can tell, no one ever talks business on a golf course. The thing that golf does well is that it allows males, especially, to bond. Men bond with other men through common activities, and for adult men, golf is as close as you can get to a universal activity. After a certain age, it's probably the most common sport-like activity for men. If you're resisting golf because it doesn't look fun, you're likely mistaken. Prior to learning how to golf just 1 year ago, I assumed that if the game was fun at all, it was a low-grade fun, and certainly not worth the time and expense. I was wrong. It turns out that golf transports your brain to another dimension for the hours you are on the course. It's like a vacation for your mind. And while I wouldn't call golf relaxing, especially if you play as poorly as I do, the simple act of putting your mind in a completely new and absorbing place can help you escape your daily worries. It's like a brain vacation. It's extraordinary, really. Women in the business world should learn golf for the same reasons as men, plus the extra reason that it opens up some tremendous dating opportunities if you're in the market. I don't know how many desirable men would prefer an average woman who golfs over a supermodel who doesn't, but I'll bet it's a substantial number. If you're a woman looking to increase your buying power in the dating pool, golf is a great competitive advantage. And you might enjoy it, too. One more thing. If you find yourself in cocktail conversation with a male over the age of 30 and you're looking for a topic of common interest, golf is a great go-to topic. I can't tell you how many times I've been asked, "Do you golf?" It annoyed the hell out of me until I learned the game. Now I'm happy that I can so easily find common ground on a feel-good topic. Proper grammar. No matter how smart you are, educated people will think you're a moron if your grammar is lacking. I'm not an expert in this category, but let me tell you the few common grammar errors that make me cringe. Each of these is like leaving the restroom with toilet paper stuck to your shoe. People notice. If I were... When you talk about the hypothetical future, use were instead of was. Don't say, "If I was to go with you, I would enjoy myself." Say, "If I were to go with you, I would enjoy myself." This rule of grammar is a big one. If you get were, was grammar wrong, it's a red flag to people who know the difference. Non-words. It's a good idea to use words that are actually in the dictionary. For most of my life, I believed brang was a word, as in, "He brang me the ball." It was common usage in the small town where I grew up. In my late 20s, I was mortified to learn that I had been speaking a hillbilly language for most of my life. Brang is not in the dictionary. Brought is. Supposably isn't a word either. Try supposedly. Frustrated isn't a word. Frustrated is. Library isn't a word. Library is. Nuclear isn't a word. Nuclear is. Hopefully. Most people misuse the word hopefully. It's bad grammar to say, "Hopefully she will bring the dessert." Hopefully should be an adverb. Say instead, "We waited hopefully for dessert." In the latter case, hopefully is correctly modifying the verb waited. In the first example, hopefully just sits there like the wrong word choice. I and me. The single most important grammar rule to master is when to use I and when to use me. I'll bet less than 20% of the general public gets that right. Normally, it wouldn't matter that 20% of the public is judging you. That still leaves a strong majority that isn't, and for most purposes, that would be fine. The problem is that the 20% in this case tend to be the most well-educated and successful folks. Those are the same people you might someday want to impress if you're asking for a job, trying to get venture funding for your startup, or proposing marriage. The simple rule for I versus me is that the sentence has to make sense if you remove the other person mentioned in the sentence. For example, if you say, Bob and I went to a movie, it would still make sense if you removed Bob and said, I went to a movie. If the sentence is, please give the documents to Bob and me, you can remove Bob